Because it's fiction and part of John Tolton's new novel, High Country Nocturne, we're going to leave some of those questions unanswered. But because the book spends a lot of time in Arizona and because Tolton knows this area extremely well, we've invited him on to talk about it and make some other observations about Phoenix. And by the way, he'll be at Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale tonight at 7. Tolton is a former business columnist for the Arizona Republic. He now writes about the economy for the Seattle Times and about Arizona and current issues at roguecolumnist.com. Now, John, once we've got through the introduction, we have a couple minutes left for the interview, so thanks for coming in.
Steve, it's great to be back.
Welcome back to your hometown. Let's talk first about the Mapstone book. You've got him in another sort of sticky situation. How is writing these books changed? Because you've written them in three different places now. You wrote them before you moved back to Phoenix. You wrote some in Phoenix. Now you're writing some from Seattle. How does your perception of Phoenix change in the books because of that?
Well, this is the eighth Mapstone, and the very first, Concrete Desert, was written in Cincinnati, kind of as a love letter home, when I thought I would never come back here. And so the first three books were written in other places, and then the next several were written while I was living here, and one critic said that the books got progressively darker as I was writing them from here. But this represents the end of a three-story arc that began with South Phoenix Rules, continued with the Night Detectives, and now ends with the High Country Nocturne. It's not the end of the series, I hope, but it is the end of the story arc. So if you're not familiar with the characters, I would urge you to start with an earlier book. But my perception permanently changed from coming back home after having been away for 22 years. And because I have a condo here, and I don't just come here in the winter, here I am in June, I still am in very close touch with Phoenix.
In the past, we've talked about how Raymond Chandler's books had Los Angeles as a character. And I know when you started these, Phoenix was a character. Do you still feel like Phoenix is a main character in these books?
Absolutely. Phoenix is an essential character. Phoenix is a magical, maddening, deeply historical, whether people realize it or not, crazy, you fall in love with it and it breaks your heart kind of city. And having it as the character in the series is more than ever.
Yeah, I wonder too, John, you're in the process, I know how long you've been in the process of putting together a history of Phoenix. And I don't know if you can talk about that a little bit, but when you think about something like that and how expansive it is part of this actually teaching people that there is a history to Phoenix?
Sure. I mean, David Mapstone is a historian, and he's a native Phoenician, and so everywhere he goes, he sees the history, and I hope it goes down with a spoonful of sugar. I am writing a concise history of Phoenix for the History Press, but I'm also working on a much larger magnus opus that if I can work it in between the mystery novels, may come out someday.
Do you have a certain theory or thesis when you think about Phoenix? I mean, I know we can't really compress that into 1 minute, but your certain philosophies about what makes Phoenix so interesting and so maddening to you?
Well, it is so interesting because it is this utterly unique oasis that there's nothing like it between the middle of the country and the West Coast, where all these rivers come together. It's very well watered. You have this rich alluvial soil. I wrote a Rogue columnist post about the agricultural years, and I called it American Eden, and that's what this place was. Phoenix lives with contradictions. It is the place of rugged individualists who come here to reinvent themselves, and yet it's a place that over and over and over again has been rescued by the federal government. And so you go through these contradictions, and Phoenix is one of the most conflicted places with itself that you can find in the country.
When we think about how the role that Phoenix, or more broadly Arizona, plays in High Country Nocturne, your latest novel, is it a villain? Is it an antagonist? Is it more complicated than that?
Well, it is a lover. It is an antagonist. It is a propulsive force. It is the utterly unique setting that drives the plot. And, of course, Phoenix is not the same as the Salt River Valley is not the same as Metro Phoenix, is not the same as Arizona. So part of the book takes place in the high country, and I hope I do justice to that, too.
And we have to get this in, John. Valley of the Sun, you're not a fan of the phrase, or at least the valley as opposed to Phoenix. Why is that?
Well, because we're competing in a global economy made up of cities. Whether we want it or not, we're competing against Shanghai and Amsterdam and Seattle and Austin for talent and capital, two things that can go anywhere. And I hate to use the word brand, but we need to have a brand that's not Valley, because then you have to say Silicon Valley, the Valley of the Jolly Ho-Ho-Ho Green Giant. I don't know what that means. When you have one of the most magical city names on earth, Phoenix, use it.
John, I've not seen your checking your savings account, so I will say this without a paycheck, I don't know. Do you prefer writing fiction or nonfiction?
I like both. If I had been better at choosing my parents, I probably would have written history and then on the side written fiction.
That's John Talton, author of the new Arizona-based mystery High Country Nocturne. He also writes an economics column for the Seattle Times. And you can read his opinions about Arizona and the rest of the world at roguecolumnist.com. Now joining the conversation for a few minutes is attorney Grady Gammage, who's also a senior fellow with the Morrison Institute. Grady, good morning.
Hey, Steve. Hi, John.
Hey, Grady.
I'm looking forward to the new novel. I can hardly wait.
Well, you're the one who said a great city has to have a great detective, and since this is SmackDown, I was thinking that it's Grady the Assassin Gammage versus John the Undertaker Talton.
Yeah, it sounds cool. Are you wearing a bodysuit?
Oh, yeah.
Undertaker?
No one wants to see that, Grady, but thank you for mentioning that. Grady, water use, dealing with the drought, climate change, Arizona gets some points for being better off than California. Do you think that's legitimate?
Yeah, it is legitimate. The governor talked about this yesterday at the East Valley Forum, which incidentally, John, is now using the name Phoenix East Valley. And I agree with you about dropping Valley of the Sun. Phoenix is a fabulous name that we should capitalize on. And even some of the outlying communities are now doing that. We are legitimately, I think, should be recognized for having been planning for the kind of dilemma that the whole West is now facing longer and more seriously than California has, or than most of the West has, frankly. It doesn't mean we should rest on our laurels and feel like there's no issue on the horizon at all. But because we're the junior right holder, because we're a desert city, because this has always been a big challenge here, we are better prepared, I think, than almost anywhere else in the arid West.
I would agree with almost everything my friend Grady says. That we risk getting lumped in with California and some of these other states that have really serious water issues. We have to remember that the Salt River Valley and the Sonoran Desert is one of the most well-watered places in the western United States. And so in addition to some good planning and tons of federal money, we're very blessed that way. Now, how that changes with climate change, we have to find out. But we have to get the story out that Arizona's water issues are very complicated. It's not we're running out of water.
But what happens with California with their claims to the Colorado River, even if Arizona has done better planning? If California can Bigfoot Arizona, what are the potential issues there, Green?
Well, one of the things that we said yesterday, and that actually I was quoted in the paper this morning saying, is we're beginning to pick up signals in sort of commentaries and blogs in California that go something like, hey, Arizona's got all this water they stored underground. They should be using that, and we should get more of their water to use in California now, which is penalizing us for having been prudent and rewarding them for having ignored the issue for a long time. And that's beginning to make us nervous. If as I think all your listeners probably understand by this time, if there's a shortage on the river, we take it first on the CAP. But the first level shortage only hits agriculture. The second level shortage begins to hit cities, And that's when we would plan to use some of the water we've banked underground, or hopefully some of the SRP water may still be available at that point. And so that's why we feel as though we're in a better position. California doesn't have those kinds of things to fall back on.
What California does have is its congressional delegation.
Exactly.
And we go back to the 50s and the 60s and men like Craig Hosmer and Chet Holifield in California, who fought like the Dickens against the CAP. And ironically, or fortuitously, Jack Williams and Ronald Reagan came to an understanding. But Arizona's congressional delegation is going to have to get involved and really push back, because believe me, California will use its political power.
Yeah, you know, John, another thing I'm beginning to sense is a narrative that goes something like, why are we growing cotton and alfalfa in central Arizona if we don't have enough water to grow vegetables in California? And vegetables should take priority. And this is an interesting argument. We've never had different crops necessarily being prioritized. And maybe we should have. Maybe that's not a bad idea. But I think there's the beginning of an attempt to sort of demonize some of Arizona's agricultural use.
And misunderstand it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Grady, John talked about California a little bit. And I think one of the questions that I'd like to talk with both of you about for just a few minutes, all the time we have left, is sort of this leadership issue, whether that comes from elected officials or not, or what the expectations are. John, you've often been cynical about where the leadership comes, in part because we don't have headquarters here, et cetera.
A little skeptical.
A little skeptical. Okay. And Grady, what are your thoughts on that? There's always the next generation of folks that we think are going to be the leaders. Are they actually here?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of problems. One is the business problem John points out. A second problem is that since the CAP got built and funded, we sort of eased up on worrying about this for the last 30 years or so. And the people who were the water buffaloes, the water leaders of that era, have disappeared. And there really aren't any water speakers. It's like Esperanto, you know, in the legislature at the moment. The new Kyle Center that we started at ASU is actually trying to start a program to educate elected officials about water issues in Arizona and how to talk about water issues in Arizona. John pointed out earlier, we need a much more sophisticated understanding of what Arizona's water situation is. And that's a level of sophistication that is largely missing in a lot of elected officials in Arizona.
This is the first time that we do not have a water senator. For years and years, we had Carl Hayden. For decades, he was the workhorse. Barry Goldwater was the show horse. And Ernest McFarland was a water senator. And then we had John Kyle as our water senator. He was the workhorse. McCain was the show horse. I don't know if Jeff Flake will evolve into that, but in the Senate, we've got to have what has always been the Arizona water senator.
Yeah, I will say, John, I think Senator Flake is trying. He knows this. I mean, he's aware that there is sort of a gap there. And I've seen him in two recent water forums actually listening to people, which is kind of amazing for a senator to start with. And he wants to step up, I think. Not there yet, probably, but wants to be there.
John, final thoughts?
I think that we have the elephant in the room, and that is sprawl. We cannot keep sprawling under the conditions that we're facing. In my ideal world, we would pull back into the footprint of the Salt River Project, but certainly not keep expanding. And this is probably where Grady's head will explode.
Grady, about 30 seconds.
Yeah, he's wrong. I'll plug a book I'm working on for Island Press that is about whether or not Phoenix is sustainable. And, you know, we are not the poster child for sprawl. People think we are. I think we will continue to grow on the edge even as we become more dense in the center part of the city. Clearly, we're not going to pull back to the SRP boundaries. And I don't think we need to. I think we can continue to grow in the pattern we have, But I do think we're going to grow more slowly, and I think that's a good thing. And I think we're going to grow in a more diversified economic way than just subdivisions and trying to lure people here from the Midwest.
Well, a lot of people
the promise of a cheap house.
A lot of people would say it's about time. Grady Gamage, attorney, also a senior fellow with the Morrison Institute. Grady, thank you as always.
Sure. Glad to talk to you.
And John Talton, author of the new Arizona-based mystery High Country Nocturne. You can also find him writing columns for the Seattle Times and read his opinions about Arizona and the rest of the world at roguecolumnist.com. You can see him tonight at 7 as well with his new book at Poison Pen in Scottsdale. John, thanks as always.
Thanks, Steve.